This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm Christopher Cruz in the Washington Bureau. We have breaking news at this hour. An extraordinary event in American history. A former president is now facing federal criminal charges. CBS News confirms Donald Trump has been indicted. It's a multi-count indictment involving obstruction and the retention of national defense information. The latest from CBS's Scott McFarlane.
It was Donald Trump on his social media platform who announced he is to appear in court at 3 p.m. Eastern Time at the federal court in Miami. That's the Southern District of Florida. He's characterizing this as the boxes hoax, which has been his way of referring to the investigation into classified records that the federal agents seized from his property August 8th and have given rise to a special counsel investigation. And for nearly a year, a broad-based probe with grand juries and witnesses of the former president of the United States.
In a statement tonight, Trump said, "I never thought it possible that such a thing could happen to a former president of the United States. I am an innocent man." Well, this wasn't a good day to be outside. Those wildfires in Canada continue to pour smoke into the Mid-Atlantic and the Northeast. More from reporter Delia Gonsalves at CBS affiliate WUSA-TV in Washington.
Oh, my God, it's real bad, yes.
Foreman Rolando Velasquez says between the air and the asphalt, a mask is the best way to battle through the elements. He's learned his lesson after all. He says he skipped the mask yesterday, only to wake up to a dry and irritated throat.
I feel the difference, yes. That's why I'm using it today.
Tell me what it's like to be out here.
It's kind of, rough, you know, but we got to do what we got to do.
I'm Tom Foti. With a huge part of the U.S. now breathing unhealthy and ugly air due to smoke moving south from record Canadian wildfires, President Biden says U.S. firefighting help will be increased.
We already have 600 American firefighters on the ground and been there for a while in Canada, including hotshots and the smoke jumper crews.
And Mr. Biden says he's promised Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau that additional U.S. resources will be sent north to help.
The U.S. Supreme Court today upheld by a 5-4 vote a lower court ruling that a Republican-drawn congressional district map in Alabama violates the Voting Rights Act. CBS News legal analyst Jessica Levinson.
Chief Justice John Roberts, joined by his conservative colleague Justice Kavanaugh and all of the liberals, really said there is still teeth to the Voting Rights Act. He starts the opinion by going all the way back to the 15th Amendment and talking about why we needed the Voting Rights Act at all.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 0.5%. This is CBS News.
Sponsored by Progressive Insurance. Protect your family, your phone, and your furry friends with life, electronic device, and pet health insurance.
Don't change the station, but do watch out for deer, would ya? You know, they're running around all willy-nilly. It is the Cripscast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Here's what you need to know in western Wisconsin. I'm Jimmy Cuska. The USDA's National Drought Monitor says that 88% of Wisconsin is abnormally dry, and a quarter of the state is in moderate drought. And the part of the state in drought includes nearly all of Polk County, as well as parts of neighboring counties, as well as areas south of I-90 in southwestern Wisconsin. The National Weather Service says that over the next 6 to 10 days, the state will see continued above average temperatures and below normal precipitation. The Amory City Council voted 4-1 to reinstate Bethany Escrow. She is an administrative assistant to the police department who was fired in May in part for her role in Facebook posts critical of the city's government and employees. And a test well in the town of Campbell was free of PFAS contamination. The town's drinking water has previously tested for unsafe levels of PFAS. An engineering firm said the cost of a new well for the town would cost about $500,000. The town says it plans to work with the DNR and to seek grants to see if they can add a new deeper well for drinking water. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
The Todd Alba Show.
We'll be moving to the afternoon, Monday through Friday, 1 until 3. Trigvi Olsen has graciously agreed to follow us into the afternoon. We're going to get to talk about the Lincoln Project and politics in Wisconsin, all across the state of Wisconsin.
I know, isn't that exciting? Where the beer is cold, the cheese curds are squeaky, the Harleys roar, the Eagles soar, and the Packers score, Todd.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
What is the grand prize? Is it a fabulous cash prize?
You definitely get to take home the cheese. I know
would
that.
I hope so. Humans aren't necessarily logical creatures. Maybe it is.
Thrill-seeking.
It's the thrill of the cheese and the bragging rights.
The first person across the line wins and gets to keep the cheese.
And that's it.
And I think that's it.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
More straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It's the final batch of 180 million barrels from the nation's stockpile that the president last spring pledged to release over 6 months. Today, saying the reserve is still more than half full, but Republicans
say the reserve is half empty. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I'm sure your news is both half empty and half full. What do you have for us today?
Well, first up, in Nigeria, unusually intense seasonal rains have triggered the worst flooding in years, damaging homes, infrastructure, and vast swaths of farmland. The intense flooding has killed more than 600 people and displaced more than a million, aggravating food and fuel shortages in Africa's most populous nation. Extreme rainfall is directly linked to man-made global warming. Here in the U.S., in Florida, inland flooding is still receding weeks after Hurricane Ian. Officials now warn of a surge in infections of flesh-eating bacteria. Oh. The bacteria thrive in warm, brackish waters and can be deadly. 29 people have been infected in hard-hit counties so far. 4 have died.
It's just getting better and better down there, isn't it?
In other news, a new study finds that PFAS chemicals, a class of chemicals widely used in household and industrial products that are linked to kidney and liver disease and cancer, are likely polluting most U.S. waterways. The study found detectable levels of PFAS chemicals in 83% of waterways tested in the United States. The Biden EPA has begun the process of regulating PFAS chemicals.
Aren't those the same PFAS chemicals that are also found in everyone's bloodstream at this point?
Yes.
Not good.
President Biden on Wednesday announced the release of an additional 15 million barrels of oil from the nation's Strategic Petroleum Reserve to lower rising gas prices that are driving inflation. Although gas prices have been falling and domestic oil production is returning to pre-pandemic levels, Saudi Arabia's OPEC Plus oil cartel recently voted to cut production to raise global oil prices, helping Russia to fund its brutal war on Ukraine. The Saudis' move is widely seen as a ploy to boost Republicans' chances in the November 8 midterm elections. If Republicans win control of Congress, they will slow down America's shift away from gas and oil. The midterms are hugely consequential for the future of climate policy and clean energy. While Democrats have passed the most significant climate legislation in U.S. history through the Inflation Reduction Act and last year's bipartisan infrastructure bill, Republicans at both the state and federal levels have vowed to dismantle climate policies, handcuff agencies, expand oil and gas drilling, and weaken pollution standards. Politico reports that state governors' races are critical for climate, particularly in swing states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Arizona, where Democrats face Trump-endorsed Republican climate science deniers. It matters because state officials will control a significant chunk of infrastructure funding from the Democrats' landmark climate law, deciding how and where and if to deploy it.
Are they allowed to use it to drill for more oil?
They might just find a way to do that.
I bet they will.
But some good news. The Biden administration announced it will hold the first ever offshore wind lease sale for energy projects off the coast of California. Finally, some accountability news. The state of New Jersey this week became the latest to announce a lawsuit against five oil majors, including Exxon and BP and the American Petroleum Institute, for deceiving consumers about climate change in violation of state law. Multiple investigations have proven that the companies knew since the 1950s that burning their product would cause catastrophic climate change, and the companies chose to spend millions on a decades-long massive disinformation campaign to sow doubt about climate science. New Jersey Attorney General Matthew Platkin cited the rising costs of climate disasters and infrastructure damages, saying the oil industry, not taxpayers, should pay.
It's long overdue that these betrayals of their customers and of the public come to an end, and that the perpetrators of these lies pay for their conduct, and that the people of New Jersey receive restitution for all that they have lost.
Go New Jersey. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. We will be returning on January 3rd.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about as we come to you from Ottumwa, Iowa. Yes, the home of Tom Arnold, one of the good friend of the show, going to be here today. Going to get some thoughts on this beautiful little community. And, you know, me, the only thing that I ever really knew about Ottumwa was the Hormel strike here. So when a listener to our free and a viewer of our free speech TV show, Heidi reached out to us and said, hey, you've got to come here to Ottumwa, because the labor folks here, you know, want to meet you, want to see what you do and all of that. We said, turn the bus around. That's where we're going. So we decided that, hey, Ottumwa, Iowa, here we come. Reached out to our good friend Tom Arnold and said, hey, what do we do here? And look, one of the first places we went to was the canteen downtown. It's this really cool little, very little lunch counter place that evidently, you know, we'll talk later with Tom about this, but was, you know, kind of the impetus of the one show that he helped create with Roseanne. And it was funny. We walk into this place and understand this tiny little building's been there forever. It's an institution in this community. They wanted to build a parking garage on this spot, and the owner's like, no, not doing it. So they literally built the parking garage around this little lunch shop. And I'm looking at him going, this is fabulous. You could only do something like this in small town America. And look, we got a great tour of the area, spent a lot of time, you know, talking with people about, you know, the hopes, the dreams, the thoughts, all of that stuff. And what a cool little community. We got to get to look at the college. We got to go over where the meatpacking plants are and where the factories are, and got the whole spiel. So today on the program, we're going to spend a little time talking with, you know, some people running for political office, some folks, local historian going to be here, and, well, of course, Ottumwa's favorite son, actor Tom Arnold. And now, look, if you've missed any of this tour, the Working Class Heroes Tour, and I've gotten tons of response from folks saying, you know, hey, we love this. Hey, come here next year. Next year when we do this again, because this has been so overwhelmingly popular with people. Everywhere we go, people are like, hey, well, thank goodness you're here. You know, we're hoping you were coming here, and have just given us nothing but love and nothing but open arms. It has been fantastic. And look, the thing that I keep getting from people is going, I'm so glad you're talking about what's important.
Because on this tour, and I've said this a couple of times already, no one has come up to me and go, well, what do you think about which bathroom someone should... Nobody talks about that. What people are talking about is, hey, how do we revive that era that you talk about, Rick? How do we get back to that prosperity of the past? How do we recreate that Leave It to Beaver era? And what's interesting is we were in Sioux City, Iowa, and I had a listener said, hey, you know, it's great that you were in Sioux City, and it's great that you were talking about Leave It to Beaver Land and all of that, but did you know? And I didn't know that Jerry Mathers was actually from Sioux City. So Beaver was from a place that we were already there talking about Leave It to Beaver Land, and Sioux City was another one of those places. Same kind of scenario. Strong union environment, strong union jobs, good solid standard of living for the working class. And well, again, the story, no matter what city we go to, the story's the same. There were factories, there were mills, there were jobs there that unions made good jobs. Because understand, none of these jobs, the packing house, the factories, the mills, none of those were good jobs. None of them. None of them were easy jobs. None of them were safe jobs. None of them were any of that until the workers organized, until they were union jobs. And I said the other day on a press call, I said, look, you know, the reality is we don't want dirty factories back. We don't want dangerous working condition jobs back. Nobody really wants those back. What they want is they want what the unions built. And this is why, again, I come back to what Joe Biden is doing. Talking about reshoring manufacturing, and yes, we're going to do that. Talking about, you know, reinvesting in infrastructure and heavily, but also creating union jobs. And I don't care whether you're a dishwasher, a sanitation worker, a doctor, a nurse. I don't care what you are. In this moment, every working person should be looking to make their job better by doing what? By joining and forming unions. Now, understand, the wealth class has spent enormous sums of money telling us, no, you don't need those dirty jobs. Talk to a couple of people who remember the old Hormel plant. Those jobs were paying, back in the 70s, like 10, 12 bucks an hour. Real good wages, solid upper middle class wages. Now it's hard work. It's you break back work. But those jobs got gutted. Because of, well, a number of reasons. Corporate greed being at the top of the list. Mismanagement being at the top of the list. But I look at this and you go, you know, when they were union jobs, they were good jobs. And they're still okay union jobs. They should be better. And you ask some of the people that, and they'll tell you, well, we're working on that. But I'll tell you, right now, more than ever, we need a working class. We need a working class revival. And today, again, we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk a little bit about our time here in Ottumwa. Also want to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell us what you think. Back after this. Stick around from Ottumwa, Iowa.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1999. That was the day that 270 workers from the Embassy Vacation Resorts in Maui voted to join Local 5 of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union. Local 5 got its start in Hawaii in 1938. Back then, it was called the Hotel and Restaurant Employees and Bartenders International Union. Today, it's a local of Unite Here. Local 5 was part of the surge of union organizing in Hawaii during the 1930s and 1940s. Starting in the 1950s, tourism became increasingly important for the Hawaiian economy. From 1940 to 1957, sugar production jobs on the island declined from 35,000 down to 17,000. With the rise of air travel, more and more jobs opened up in the tourism industry. Today, tourism is the largest growing gross domestic product of Hawaii. It represents 21% of the Hawaiian economy. Visitors spent $14 billion on the islands in 2012. Yet the service sector workers who made this growth of the tourism industry possible often work long hours for low wages. Many resorts and hotels fight any effort to bring in a union. Such was the case at the Embassy Vacation Resorts. In 1998, the employees voted against forming a union by a count of 126 to 86. The union challenged the results of the election and won. They held a second election the next year. During their organizing drive, four employees were fired at the resort. In 2003, the National Labor Relations Board found that the employees had been let go for their union activities. The company was ordered to reinstate the workers. These legal decisions were victories by the service workers of Hawaii in their fight to win union protections. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
So we're here in Ottumwa, Iowa. And again, you know, this is one of these beautiful places. And my friend Tom Arnold, you know, said, hey, you've got to go to these certain places to grab. And we talked to him the other day. So you got to go get dinner here. You got to get lunch here. And this is a fabulous community. And, you know, the thing that gets me is, you know, we're told that there all this divisive stuff is what's important. If you talk to the good folks here in Iowa, as we've been doing these last several days, it's not that. It's about the kitchen table stuff. It's about the jobs. It's about making better opportunities for their kids. That's why I've asked Diana Schwartz to come talk with us. Diana is a UAW member. She was one of the John Deere striking workers from not too long ago and also a candidate for State House. And thank goodness more union members, more working people stepping forward, stepping up, and deciding to run for office. Diana, thanks for taking some time for us.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So let's start with the question I ask just about everybody when they get into this. Why would you do this to yourself? What is wrong with you?
Well, after the strike was over, I am on the CAP Council, which endorses candidates for political campaigns. The Kelly Harrison, who is the UAW over the whole rep over the whole state of Iowa, she Iowa Democrats contacted me and they said, we'd like to interview you. So they interviewed me, and they called me the next day and said, you'd be the perfect candidate. So after I thought about it, after being on the picket line and realizing I was fighting for just not myself but for others to make a better life for everybody, I thought, why not? If I don't do it now, I'll never do it, and I'll probably regret it for the rest of my life. So that's why I did it.
No, and again, you know, I find this over and over again. People go, you know, hey, why not me? And I go, why not working people? You know what the issues are. You know what's important. You know, all of this stuff that we're force-fed from, you know, from all of these talking heads, not what average everyday working people care about. Mm-hmm. So when you're out there knocking on the doors, shaking hands, kissing babies, doing all that stuff, what are people telling you are the important issues?
Well, I mean, a lot of people don't. They always tell me, well, I don't really have any issues. But when I bring up what I have on my my talking points is the first thing I talk about is workers' rights, which is getting collective bargaining back, Chapter 20 here in Iowa for teachers, state workers, county workers, city workers, because they took that away in 2017 when the Republicans took control of the State House. Then they changed workman's comp where they gutted it so you can't choose the doctor you can go to. They cut the benefits, so if you get hurt on the job, they're not going to give you as much money for a shoulder injury, especially because that was what the meat packers were after, because there's a lot of shoulder injuries in the meat packing industry.
Right.
And unemployment, what just happened, the Republicans took away 10 weeks of unemployment from us, so now it's just 16 weeks. And I can relate to that because in 2017, right before I got hired by John Deere, I had been unemployed just about 6 months where my unemployment was ready to run out, and I finally got a job at John Deere, thank God. And, yeah, I understand. You know, they say people are just at home sitting on the couch drawing unemployment. Well, sorry, that's not it. And then the next one is public education, which Iowa's trying to push for vouchers where they want to give money to the private schools, and the teachers are up in arms about it. I'm against it because we already give the public or the private schools $90.8 million out of our tax-paying dollars. So why should we give them another up to $75 million for private vouchers to take away from these schools? You start taking money away from the public schools, which they already do now. The public schools, we're on the downhill slide here in Iowa. We used to be like one of the top states in the country for education. We've slipped down into the middle 20s, maybe down to the lower that. And you'd start taking money away. These smaller communities who identify with their schools will no longer have a school because the money won't be there. Yep. And they, you know, it could be like one school per county. Like Atumwa could be the only school in Wapello County and everything. And we, right now, we have Eddyville, Blakesburg, Fremont, and we have Cardinal. So we have two other schools besides Atumwa. And then my third one is voters' rights, because in 2020, after the election, our legislature changed the law to make it harder to vote. They cut down the early voting time, who can pick up your absentee. The auditors can't send out absentee ballot requests to people like they used to with our names and everything already on it. So that's a big issue with people on how they've changed that. And then last but not least, a lot of people still, it's women's rights. A lot of women get fired up about that. When I say that last, women are like, oh, I didn't think you were going to say anything about that. And I'm like, yes, I am. So I really think probably if I got down to the two, it's public education and women's rights.
Now you got all that in just under about 3 minutes. And so that's a good spiel right there. That's a good knock on a door. So you've got the door thing down. But let's go back to the first part of it, the workers' rights part, because I keep saying all the time, and I get a lot of flack from listeners, Republicans hate working people. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. It's in their policies. And as you've pointed out, when they've been given control, what have they done for working people? And what they've done to them is they've attacked them at every opportunity and taken from them the ability to support their families and fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. So to me, it seems like, as a working person, I don't know why you would vote for that.
And that's a good question, because I hate to say this, but a lot of our people in the education field, I knew people, teachers, who voted Republican, and then what they happened in 2017? They lost their collective bargaining, you know, so they no longer have it. And now they're after them for the vouchers. And, you know, that's where people have to realize the Republicans aren't your friend. And, that, you know, and I sort of, when I talk to people and people say, you know, I'm a Republican, I had one lady tell me that, and I says, I can't vote for you. And I said, and why is that? And she sort of looked aghast at me like,
well, why is that?
And I go, she goes, well, I guess I never thought of it before. And I said, well, I said, really? I said, if you look at my policies, I said, if you're for public education, if you're for workers' rights, voters' rights, and women's rights, I said, we don't have to agree on everything. I said, but if you look at me, I said, I think my policies probably align more with you than the Republicans do. And she goes, well, you know, I never thought of it that way before. She took my card where she wasn't going to take it, and she said she'd think about it and look at me. So, and I've done that a lot with people that weren't going to take my cards. And my husband does, and when he knocks on the door. So, you know, it's just sometimes there's some of them that just tell me, we're Republicans. Like yesterday, a woman just slammed the door in my face. Okay, you can't argue with those people.
And there are fives, move along.
Yes. So, but most of the people, I mean, some of them I can sort of talk, and at least they'll take my card, and at least they'll look at me. And I figure that's a win.
No, I mean, at the end of the day, when you talk about the right issues, and you know, what the mainstream media has done, our corporate-controlled mainstream media has done, is focused us on all of the wrong things. And I keep coming back to what the wealthy have done masterfully is they've divided us on issues that aren't really important to the average family. And the things that are important to us, we never seem to talk about, and we don't have politicians that really focus on. So it's good to hear that you're out there, you're pushing this message. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Diana Schwartz. She's a candidate for State House here in Iowa, also a UAW member and John Deere worker. Check out her website, DianaSchwartz4Iowa.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Now, again, I go back to this moment where, you know, you're out there talking to people, and again, this kind of push towards, you know, the kitchen table stuff, the education part. Every parent wants their kids to get the best education, and they've been sold this idea that, you know, teachers are indoctrinating their mm-hmm. children with some theory about race that's critical, or, you know, other nonsense. Do you get that when you're out there talking to people? Is this something that's filtered in, or are the real issues like the privatization schemes that are set up to destroy public education and make that a commodity? Is that something people are focused on?
Well, I mean, most people, you know, they worry about public education, but I mean, I can really say the people that have brought up that they think people are indoctrinating their kids and everything like that, it's only been a very, like, less than, you know, probably a handful, you know, if that. You know, they bring it up, and I just sort of say, I don't know where you're getting your information, but I've talked to teachers, and no, that's not happening. And but they don't believe it, so there's, you can't really discuss it with them because they're not going to, you're not going to change their mind. Yeah. You know, and that's why I just sort of say, okay, thank you for your time. I usually always thank them, and I think a lot of them are rude to me, and I just say, thank you for talking to me, and I move on, because there is no use of trying to tell them otherwise, because they believe in that, like they call it the woke theory, and I just, yeah.
Yeah, they've been spending a lot of time watching Fox News and all of that. But, you know, here, this is one of those things where you look at, you know, I get this a lot. It's not my kids' teachers who are doing this. No. Mm-hmm. It's those other teachers. We know they're out there. And they don't actually know that it's happening. It's what they've been told on the F channel. It's what right-wing blather has filled their head with. And more and more, especially as I'm coming across Iowa, I'm talking to a lot of candidates who are saying, look, you know, toxic media has created this massive division. And I'm a person who believes how we bring this country back together is through organized labor, through bringing workers back together, fighting for collective bargaining rights, and doing things like, well, when you guys were on strike recently, nobody was talking about bathrooms or any of the other divisive stuff. They were talking about fighting for better wages, hours, conditions. That, to me, is how we reunite the country.
Oh, I agree. I mean, you know, if you don't unite, like when we were on strike, I was the picket captain, so I was in charge of my crew, and so I wanted to make sure everybody was on the picket line. They had food, they had things to drink, and I also had to make sure that I was trying to get out there and help walk with them and everything. But it's just everybody together, and if you don't work together, it isn't going to work. I mean, it, but there is a big divisiveness. I mean, I see it. I mean, like I said, I talk to a lot of people. Some of them sort of come across and listen to me. And like I said, some of them just slam the door and say, we're Republicans. We don't vote for Democrats. Poof.
Yeah, it's sad. Now, you said before we sat down that, you know, this area, Ottumwa, was a strong Democratic, you know, area. What made that change, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I've heard people say, like the guys I work with at John Deere, you know, that are Trump people, they say, oh, the Democrats they forgot about us. And I go, how did they forget about you? Oh, they just took us for granted and they just don't care about us anymore. It's the Republicans that take care of us. And I go, I don't know what you're seeing, but I said, I don't see it that way and everything. But around here, I don't really know. It's just, it's sort of like, I don't know, you see people who live in the most poor areas of town, and you wonder how they could vote, and they have Republican signs. And like I said, they're the ones who seemed more really Trump people. I had one guy who had a flag up about Biden, and I walked up to him, and I said, hi, my name is Diana Schwartz, I'm running for District 25. And the first thing out of his mouth was, what do you think of my flag? And I said, I don't really care what your flag says. And he goes, he sort of looked at me, he goes, oh, well, I figured you were going to tell me to take it down. And I said, I'm here to talk about me and what my policies are. I said, I don't really care what you put up your flagpole. I said, because it's not my job to police you. I said, I don't really care. And then he sort of was quiet, and then he was more, you know, wanted to talk and listen to me.
Wow. You're a brave one. I mean, most people wouldn't walk up to that house.
Well, I've walked up to Republicans' doors and knocked on doors, and most of them take my cards. They may not say anything, but I go up to doors that people have my opponent sign in their yard, and I knock on their door. Yeah, nothing stopped me. The only thing I didn't do yesterday, we walked by my opponent's house. My husband said, don't put a tag on his door, and I went, okay, I won't do it.
The voice of reason. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Diana Schwartz. She's running for state house here in Iowa. Diana Schwartz for Iowa.com, the website. Last thing I got to get to you. You said you brought up women's rights a moment ago. That is on people's minds, especially women, especially my daughters. You know, look, we're in the process of making women second class citizens again. As you're out there talking to people, is this front and center? Is this one of the top five? Where would you put this on the scale, you know, 1 through 5, if you had to choose?
I think here around, from what I've talked to people, I think, you know, for the teachers, public education, collective bargaining, and women's rights are sort of all up there together. Because I had a lady who's, I stopped at their house, and I knocked on the door, and her husband's a union worker, and we were talking, and she went and got her 18-year-old daughter. She goes, this is the first time she gets to vote. And she goes, I want you to meet her because she is for women's rights. You need to listen to her. And that's what this woman said to her daughter. I shook her hand, and I think her name was Zoe, and I said, it was nice to meet her. And she goes, I will be voting for you. And she goes, if you're going to stick up for women's rights? I said, absolutely. So I really think it's a big thing with women. I really do.
And yeah, I think it's the wild card in this election that, mm-hmm. that all the pollsters and people aren't paying attention to. But, you know, I'm hoping, but still, we got to come back to the bread and butter issues as well. But, Diana, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Back to knocking on the doors. You got lots of work to do.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Yes, I do.
Thanks so much. Diana Schwartz, running for State House here. Make sure you check out the website, DianaSchwartzForIowa.com. We'll get links out on social media. Going to take a quick break right back here from Ottumwa, Iowa. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the best of The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1949. That was the day Americans awoke to fears the nationwide steel strike would spread rapidly to include key fabrication plants. 500,000 steel workers had joined 400,000 coal miners on strike the morning before. The miners resolved to defend their $100 a month pension, instituting what John L. Lewis called the No Day Work Week, emboldened the steel workers to walk out of the mills. Within 24 hours, 96% of all steel production in the country was completely shut down. United Steelworker contracts were due to expire on the 15th, but the writing was on the wall. The mill owners decried anything close to mine pensions as nothing short of socialistic and refused to budge in negotiations. United Steelworkers President Phil Murray thundered that those companies that failed to agree to demands for non-contributory pensions and insurance would be shut down. But militants warned that President Truman's fact-finding board had already watered down strike demands. The president's board had been established to put off two previous strike deadlines. The guidelines it issued only encouraged steel magnates to stand tough against United Steelworker demands. These included a 30-cent raise plus increased company insurance and pension contributions. Now, it had become a defensive struggle over whether steelworkers would have to begin contributing to health and pension plans through wage cuts. By the time steelworkers ended their strike 42 days later, they had won the $100 a month pension minus what they would receive from Social Security, and they had to begin contributing to a health insurance plan with no wage increase at all. Still, workers celebrated that they had successfully defended the United Steelworkers against the all-out union-busting drive.
My newspaper died. Well, technically it still appears, but it has no life, no news, and barely a pulse. It's a mere semblance of a real paper, one of the hundreds of local journalism zombies staggering along in cities and towns that had long relied on them. Each one has a bare number of subscribers keeping it going. Mostly long-time readers like me, clinging to a memory of what used to be and a flickering hope that surely the thing won't get worse. Then it does. Our papers are getting worse at a time we desperately need them to get better because they are no longer mediums of journalism, civic purpose, and local identity. Rather, they've been reduced to little more than profit siphons, steadily piping local money to a handful of distant high-finance syndicates that have bought out our hometown journals. My daily, the Austin American Statesman, was swallowed up in 2019 by the nationwide Gannett chain, becoming one of more than 1,000 local papers Gannett presently mass-produces under its corporate banner, the USA Today Network. But even that reference is a deception, for the publication doesn't confide to readers that it's actually a product of SoftBank Group, a multi-billion-dollar Japanese financial consortium that owns and controls Gannett. SoftBank has no interest in Austin as a place, a community, or even as a newspaper market. Nor does it care one whit about advancing the principles of journalism. It's in the profit business,
extracting maximum short-term payouts from the properties it owns. This has rapidly become the standard business model for American newspapering. Today, more than half of all daily papers in America are in the grip of just 10 of these money syndicates. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's why our local papers are dying. It's not a failure of journalism, but of absentee corporate owners plundering journalism.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're coming to you from the town of Ottumwa, Iowa, on our Working Class Heroes radio tour, as we are, well, getting out on the road, talking to voters, talking to workers, spreading the good word, and, you know, getting kind of a sense of where things are going to be going here in 2022 as the election, well, is coming close. And here to share some thoughts on, well, the town of Ottumwa, also the 22 elections, Mr. Ottumwa himself. And look, you can't trip over someone in this town without them saying, hey, do you know Tom Arnold's from here? That's why I'm glad to have my good friend Tom Arnold come and share some thoughts with us. Tom, thanks for taking time for us.
You know, it's a factory town, and it always concerns me when people, my brothers that work in factories, we're supporting Donald Trump or whoever, because back in the day, Maria Shriver told me this. She came there. I saw her in 1980. It was the most Democratic county, Wapello County, in America. And everybody knew that. They came and a lot of things happened to our town. You know, I worked at the Hormel meat packing plant where we ended up having, I worked for 3 years at a high school on the kill floor where we had a very famous strike. There's a documentary called American Dream that Barbara Kopple made about it. It did not go well. It ended up with everybody getting fired. There had been a plant in Austin, Minnesota that had been on strike for a year and a half. Anyway, everybody gets fired from my plant. They just changed the name on the outside to XL and then have broken the union and then get people for half what we used to get paid. And we took some hits in the 80s back home. I went away to college. I got fired from the meat packing plant too, I have to say. I always tell people, you know how you get fired? How do you not get fired from a job? Get the crappiest job you can get. And I was chiseling heads pulling leaf lard and voting heads. And I figured out a way to get fired. And you get arrested for public nudity. People in my town know this. At the old folks' home, which is what happened to me, streaking. And you go to jail, and it will be in the paper, and you lose your job there. But, you know, it's a great place to be from. I love Iowa in general. You know, I'm grateful that I grew up where I did because it's so different than everything else I've experienced. I got a lot of really good people there. You got some scumbags, let's be honest.
But, you got those everywhere.
Yeah, well, my sister, who's now famous like I am, because they made a documentary series about her called The Queen of Meth. And in the late 80s, early 90s, she was the biggest drug dealer in America. And people say to me, weren't you embarrassed that your sister was a drug dealer? And I say, not when I was doing drugs, I wasn't. It was a great thing. But, you know, she and a whole generation of people, parents, went away to prison. And two brother-in-laws died in prison. They went away. And so there's a generation of kids that were raised by their grandparents, like, you know, my nephew was. And so that, you know, we just hope they don't repeat the cycle. And the best thing I can do is give away scholarships or, you know, support different things that I do, because that town, you know, I talk about the University of Iowa changed my life. That was my goal, to get there, to get on stage there, right? But the Indian Hills Community College, which is in Ottumwa, Iowa, it really changed our town, and it changed my life. I went there 2 years. I worked while I was at the packet plant, because now it gives people options to get skills nursing or being a mechanic or stuff that people could use. And a lot of people back there, you know, raise their families, and then they go there, and they start all new lives and get this great education. And Indian Hills really has changed our town for the better more than anything.
Yeah, our tour guide, Steve, you know, drove us around, and everything was, you know, we went through Indian Hills there, and he said, you know, Tom Arnold went here, and this is Tom Arnold, the volleyball, Tom Arnold soccer field, Tom Arnold this. It was everything.
Well, you know how, Rick, you know how you get him to name the volleyball the arena and those things for you. You give them a lot of money.
That helps.
He was an A student. We're going to honor him. But it's been my honor, and I'm very grateful. You know, they certainly treated me very well, too. And our volleyball, our college volleyball teams are crazy good, especially the women. Our college basketball, men's basketball, is great. We've won national championships out of there, and so they get good use of the stuff.
Yeah, no, our tour guide gave us the long story of your college fundraising as well. Something where you're walking across the county in your underwear or something?
Well, that's it, too. This is the first time I was ever in the National Enquirer or the New York Times. Back, I got fired from the BPAC plant, and I didn't have enough money to finish college, so I came up with a scheme. I would walk from Albia, Iowa to Ottumwa, Iowa. It's 21 miles in my underwear. This is back in like 1980, right? In my underwear and in the middle of winter. And people started donating, and some people hoped I would die on the road, but donating. And I ended up like a NASCAR. I had two vans with all the advertisement of all the donors. And then I had to do it. And somebody had made me some satin boxer shorts a month or so before that, and I gained weight. They were tight. And I always say that, you know, I did the walk, and I had a hard time having children, and I assume it's because I was so frozen from that walk. But it was very nice. People came out. It was a big thing in our town. I called it From Here to There in underwear and made shirts. And all my friends were in there was a van in front of me as we walked, and a van behind me. My friends are getting hammered in there, throwing beer cans at me because, you know, you really are out in the middle of nowhere. And then I remember a car pulls up. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's my grandma's car. She gets out with a full-length mink coat and high heels and starts walking with me. I'm on the shoulder, which is gravel. I'm like, you got to be. This is so embarrassing. You know, I'm a college student. The last thing you want is your freaking grandma powering along with you because they're filming everything. But she was great. And so then we made it and had a huge party. We had a great beer sponsor. And I made enough money to keep going to college and get me up to the University of Iowa. So I am grateful for the people there because they are the ones that got me to college before I reciprocated and gave back. But that school and those people, Southeast Iowa, those people really changed my life for the better.
No, it's a great story. And, you know, the reason I reached out to you originally is we knew we were going to be here and we were looking for places to eat. You know, this tour that we're doing going across multiple states and going into factory towns and talking with working people has been about the issues, but it's also been about me and my producer finding the best places to eat. And you pointed out the canteen, which is a cool little place. I love the story that they refused to give it up and they actually built a parking garage up and around it. It is, is such a cool little place.
Yeah, that's an Iowa place. It's about the size of my office here. I'm not kidding. And I think the ladies that worked there 100 years ago are still there.
Still there.
Turning the meat, you know, loose meat. Now, people, not everybody understands what loose meat is. And it's like sloppy Joe without the slop. But it's also the way you flavor the meat. And one of the things I did on the Roseanne show was I wrote in that Roseanne had a loose meat restaurant based 100% on the canteen in Ottumwa. You know, the show was a very working class show, and I wanted to make, you know, I had that experience myself, so I put as much of that as I could in it. But it's good. And then I told you about Happy Joe's Pizza. Happy Joe's Pizza. Happy Joe's Taco Pizza, man. You know, they have a BLT pizza, too. And I'm Jewish, but I'll eat it. I'll eat the whole thing. And I have to tell you, there must be 10,000 calories in one of those pizzas. More than that, probably. And I've eaten several before. But it's so good. And, you know, we have our fried tenderloin, deep-fried tenderloins that are so good. There's a lot to eat in Iowa.
There is. And, you know, the thing is we went to the canteen, and I was told that I wasn't allowed to order two of the loose meat sandwiches. I had to order one and then reorder. And I'm not quite sure why.
That's a tradition. You reorder. You eat the one, you say reorder, everything but pickle. And then they bring it one at a time. And I could probably get you two at once. But,
you could.
The record, my nephew ate eight of those. I think the record is on the wall there. And a lot of people that I grew up with go in there to break the record on the wall. Not to say I want to have a tasty meal. I want to that they and they make their own pies. You see that list of pies they got? It's freaking crazy. Someone just sent me a picture from back there of the list of pies, and I'm just staring at it. And the loose meat sandwiches. I'm like, oh my god, I need that.
You don't need that, because the reality is, when we sat down, I had to have three of them. Couldn't do any more. But I got to tell you, you look great. You look like you've slimmed down a bit.
Well, I have. I had a mini stroke in January. And so I've lost 80 pounds just by changing my diet. I tell people, well, I did it because of my kids. You know, they're 9 and 6. I'm a single dad. But the truth is, I had to have a mini stroke first. Then I did it for my kids. But I feel a lot better. I'm very blessed that it wasn't a bigger thing. But it was definitely a wake-up call. So I've been working with a guy that I met at Arnold Schwarzenegger's house. You only have to Zoom with him every 2 weeks. If I had to work with a trainer every day, that would make me so uncomfortable. But I do, he says, do this much cardio. There's 6 meals a day. Eat it this time, this time, this time. And the guy's a magician. You know, he's taken people far bigger than me or you and made them, normal size. That's what he does. You just have to, you know, it's no gimmick. You just got to do stuff. And we all
do stuff
as well as we can. Yeah.
Yeah. You got to do stuff and not have three loose meat sandwiches at the canteen.
No. Once in a while you can. That's a special occasion, Rick.
Yeah.
That's a special occasion. You're eating your way across the Midwest. How do you resist that? You just give it up. And then when you get back home, you jump back on the bike, man.
Jump right back. I brought my bike with me, actually. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Tom Arnold. Tumwa's favorite son, and very, very apparent, because everybody we talk to, very effusive with praise. Now, I look at this place, and I'll be honest. This is Mayberry, man. This is Leave It to Beaver Land. This is the kind of place that I would like to see all over the country. But sadly, you know, when talking to some people, there's a feeling that our politics have kind of ripped us apart. How do we bring places like Tumwa back together? How do we bring places like Eau Claire, Wisconsin back together? How do we move in that direction where we're fighting for the same things?
Well, I feel like we're almost there. You know, we have to take care of some stuff. It's not like, well, there's two sides to everything. There's some things there aren't two sides to everything, and we need to finish those off. And by that, I mean Donald Trump and the people around him. You know, I wish that the evidence and the proof and everything would turn people's heads, like my brothers, you know, or one of my sisters. But it's just, you know, everybody's locked into their stuff. So the good guys have to do the right thing. And, you know, the Republicans depend on us to get rid of Donald Trump. They always have. They're cowards. They could have gotten rid of him. They could have voted to convict him twice in the impeachment, but they didn't. So they're like, you Democrats have to get rid of this guy. Now, back when I grew up, you know, in Tumwa High, we had a government class, and half of the kids would be Democrats and half Republicans. Then we go to the state house, up at the Iowa Capitol up there in Des Moines, and then we practice. We practiced passing a law. We would debate, like healthy debate. And that was just part of growing up. My dad was a Republican. You know, the family that worked, my dad worked was a management at a factory. So he's Republican. And the guys in my family that were factory workers were all Democrats. And something has changed. You know, I think there's a populist movement that you know, I do think, and I have a theory in the country that every generation, there's a group of white people who they're looking for something. And what happens is they get led astray, whether it be in the South or the Midwest or wherever it is. And Donald Trump was certainly that guy to go, hey, I'm just like you. I think like that. And what ends up happening is those people get left behind, the people that support these guys. And other people, immigrants, people of color, move up. And there's just a thing, there is a certain population of white people they just keep buying into generation after generation, and they don't get ahead. They don't they really end up losing because, you know, they're the marks that these grifters are looking for. It's really those guys because, yep. You know, the people of color, the people, well, they're not going to. And I saw where Trump was criticizing us Jews, American Jews, you know, because first of all, I'm always shocked when I hear a Jew voted for Trump or any Republican. But, you know, because he can't. He goes, who can I manipulate? Who'll donate $5 or last $5 to me? Who'll buy a stupid hat? And after this is over, people are going to go, wow, that was not cool. But it takes a little bit, and we have to get to the end of it. You know, I think the opportunity is, well, you know, Trump isn't allegedly running. Let's really look at the other candidates on both sides. Let's look for people who will work with the other side. I mean, you know, Joe Biden, he saved the country, you know, and people hated Trump so much that 81 million of us voted for a guy that looks like Skeletor. That's why I say a guy that I get very nervous when he gets on a bike, you know, like my grandpa. I get nervous when he speaks. But he and Kamala Harris were the only two people, combination, that could win that election. Yep. And that was so important to everyone. And so, you know, these other, you know, Joe Biden is a guy that blindly thinks he can work across the aisle, do this, do that. I think he's had to figure out just how political things are. But he's certainly got a lot done. And, you know, I think once Trump goes away, which I don't know. When he flew into the Iowa State Fair when he was running, when his helicopter started giving people rides, I was like, oh, shit. I know how this is going to. People are like, oh, my God, it's a rich guy. Because people that are, there are working class people that feel that rich people are better than them. And I get that from the way I grew up. You're like, look at the rich guy. Oh, yeah, he is obviously better than me. Boy, he seems to care about my things. If you look very close at it, they don't. They care about money, and they will get their money, and they will lie to you. But if it makes you feel good, if you don't have self-esteem, which is a hard thing to come by sometimes, you know, you'll go, okay, that guy's going to give me my self-esteem. He and I are buddies, even though the guy would never invite you into his home.
There's always a con there, and that's the thing that gets me. You know, how is it that someone who has a track record of cheating workers, of cheating contractors, filing bankruptcy, screwing everybody that he's ever come in contact with, how is it that this is the guy we now put faith in that's going to help save the working class of this country? But my fear is, Tom, and this is where, you know, in talking with people, I'm seeing the Republicans making a pivot to try and get working class people on their side, even though their policies are horrible. I mean, you know, I say all the time, Republicans hate working people. Look at their policies. Nothing else. Just look at what they do. And here in Iowa, for instance, you know, they attacked unemployment insurance, cut it down from 26 to 16 weeks. They're attacking workers' compensation. Why? People like you who worked in the meatpacking plant have shoulder injuries. So they've attacked people being able to claim shoulder injuries. They're going after education. They're going after everything that matters to the working class. But yet somehow still, they're still voting for these people, man. Well, I don't get it.
They want to keep people broke and stupid. I mean, that's really what they want. They want to keep so that they're the cogs in the wheel that churns out the money. They literally, they're the we're the rat running around the thing, and people don't realize it. You know, the people I work with, there's guys with serious injuries. I'm, you know, and have had to have work done. I mean, one guy got his arm cut off. They sewed him back on, made him go back to work, but that's sort of how it was.
They sewed him back on, made him go back to work.
Yeah, they did. Sully, shout out to Kevin Sullivan. You know, they don't, it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that, you know, and I always had a huge influx of Hispanic people. Everybody that worked at the new meatpacking plant, most of them were immigrants because they're like, they want to work. First of all, meatpacking plant is hard work. My brothers were too lazy to work there, but it's hard work. And these guys are like, oh, I'll do that hard work. And so at first there was a whole thing about, okay, they're the other. And now everything is there's always jerks. But I think you go back there and you, you find good Mexican food, for instance, or good, you know, just the community is more blended than when I grew up there. I grew up there, everybody was white. You know, there's four Jewish families, four black families, and then everybody was white. And so it's changed a little bit. I don't know what's the deal with these people. It might be, and I don't know what the deal is with the religious people. I on November 1st, I have a documentary that I participated in and helped called God Forbid, the Fall of a Religious Dynasty, I think it's what it's called. It's on Hulu. It's about Jerry Falwell Jr., his wife, the pool boy, and Donald Trump. And I gave a lot of tape of Michael Cohen and I kind of researched this pool boy thing back and gave him a lot of stuff. And it boils down to is Jerry Falwell Jr., not only did he get sort of blackmailed by Michael Cohen by going, remember when I fixed that thing with the naked pictures of your wife and the pool boy and you? I still got a picture, and I need you to do me a favor, support Trump. And you see that support